reunion audio?
You have a prepaid call. You will not be
I'm Anna Dalvey, and this is the Anna Dalvey Show. You might recognize my name as a character in a Netflix series, but now you get to meet the real me. On this show, I will dive into the concept of rules and talk with the people who create or break them. From art, politics, fashion, tech, finance, law, and more, The Anna Dalvey Show will share honest, unfiltered conversations that will question traditional notions of what's right and wrong, all recorded in my East Village apartment in New York while on house arrest. This week, I'm talking with Ben Vidicom. In the early 2000s, Ben had his finger on the pulse of the It Girl craze, covering the likes of Paris Hilton and Tinsley Mortimer. He even covered me, of course. Now he writes for publications such as New York Times and The Toddler, producing for television, and recently penned his first book. Hi, Ben. Thank you so much for coming.
Hi, Anna. It's my pleasure. Nice to see you.
You and me have known each other for a while. We met in 2021. You wrote a piece about me for Toddler.
That's right.
I think, and then I got rearrested for ICE quickly after that. So tell us, what are you doing these days?
Well, just within the last 10 days, I had a documentary that I produced out on Hulu. It's called Queenmaker, The Making of an It Girl. And it's based in part on my 2020 memoir, which is a book called Gatecrasher. And a chapter in that talks about the real craze for New York City socialites and heiresses, as we called them, between about 1999 and 2010. It was all kicked off by the Hilton sisters. And there was a wave of young women who came to New York and who wanted to, embody that sense of American aristocracy. And the documentary walks you through how the women of that era, they hired a publicist. Who were the right photographers to get in front of? What was the strategy in terms of what red carpet should they be on? You know, what junior committees for local philanthropy should they be on? And the documentary has a real twist because one of the preeminent bloggers of the era has since transitioned into being a woman. So Morgan Olivia Rose, her name is. And her story epitomizes really what many of these other women were trying to do, which was become the socialite archetype. So it's a lot of fun on Hulu.
Yes. So what does gossip mean to you these days?
Oh, gosh, gossip has changed so much. So for your listeners who are not aware, I'm originally Australian. I came to New York in 98. And with a co-writer, Horatio Silva, we founded a online fashion gossip column called Chic Happens, which was one of the first ever internet gossip columns. It was before Perez Hilton. Perez or Mario, as we knew him then, was an intern at Star Magazine. He was just this kid around town. It was before Gawker, but before all the big, better-known ones. So we started this online fashion gossip column, and I became a newspaper gossip columnist off the back of it and ended up in managing editor of TMZ in 2009. And sort of got sick of gossip at that point and have worked consistently for the New York Times since then. All of that's in my book, Gatecrasher. But in those days, we were traditional media and we were the gatekeepers of gossip. And so gossip was what we decided it was. And that really exploded in 2010 with the introduction of social media. And of course, celebrities and notable people, or even normal people who became celebrities, really controlling their own narratives. So now you have Des Moines, for example, which old grizzled gossip hags like me hate, because we're like, none of this is true. This is just publicists sending this in and it's not vetted. So it is a bit ironic that we gossip journalists are, you know, saying, oh, this isn't journalism. What about standards?
I think the big thing about Des Moines is like kind of they weaponize just the general, like anybody on Instagram. It's like if anybody, like now everybody's a paparazzi pretty much. Like if somebody sees you in a city and they just submit a photo.
Oh, it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone has a camera and a recording device in their hip pocket.
Yeah.
And, a question I was asked when I was a gossip columnist was often, why is the media so interested in celebrities? And my response was always, that's a ridiculous question. You never ask, why is the media so interested in magazines about golf or baking shows? There's no media interest. It's just what people are interested in. You might as well ask, why is a supermarket so interested in carrots or eggs? It's because people want it.
Yeah.
And the secret thing that we can never really say because it would offend the audience for our gossip was, the problem is the audience. It's not the journalist.
Yeah.
It's because people are hungry. I mean, you in your own life have experienced it. People love to see personalities built up and torn down. It's a spectator sport. It is like the gladiators arena in Rome. And it's the massive public hunger for this bloody spectacle of celebrities being ripped apart in front of them. And now that everyone has their own recording device, they're doing it for themselves. Mm-hmm. So the problem was never really the gossip press, in my opinion, as a gossip reporter, former. The problem is that people love to see it.
Yeah. So it's a bit like a two-way street. It's they're feeding the appetite and they're also creating.
Well, it's really eating itself because now we have the phenomenon of the main character on social media or Twitter. And we all know you don't want to be the main character. I mean, on yesterday it was some poor woman, like kind of a nobody, who did this long Twitter thread about analyzing her privilege because she went to see Taylor Swift. And she was just mocked left, right, and center because who are you? And she calls herself a public figure, which is, I think, opened the gates to ridicule because she has 8,000 followers. And people are like, who is this girl? Like 8,000 followers? So she goes, as a public figure, I'm interrogating my privilege going to Taylor Swift. And it honestly, it was pretty innocuous.
Yeah.
It was mildly obnoxious at best, but there was just this, you know, feeding frenzy of regular users on Twitter piling on her, you know, tearing her apart, taking their bit of flesh. The poor woman was chased off Twitter. And that's the phenomenon we see. You don't want to be the main character anymore. So I think the danger is that you are both audience, but if you put a foot wrong, you know, you could be the target as well.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So what's like your relationship like now with Twitter, for example, now that after Elon Musk bought it?
I'm not an Elon fan. I do observe it because, you know, I'm a communications professional, so it behooves me to know what's going on in the world. I post very minimally. I was obliged to get back on to promote Queenmaker because I was a producer. I'm in the show and, like, I can't not promote it. But I hate it. And, you know, it's, I think one of the problems with social media is that it really privileges and advantages like the worst people, the most shameless people, the biggest narcissists who just want to talk about themselves all day and just want to sell something. Look, and that's fine. I'm a capitalist. Sell something. Make your bag. I don't care. Make your coin. But many of us are not built like that. And I think it really, you get kind of steamrolled if you don't really feel like talking about yourself all day, every day. So consequently, I don't post unless I would be doing a disservice to, you know, Hulu and the production company that made the film. I've got to support it, but I would prefer never to post.
Yeah. So what's like your favorite platform these days?
Oh, well, I do enjoy TikTok for all the stupid reasons that everyone does. But even that is you know, deteriorating in front of our eyes. Look, I like a dumb video as much as the next person, but I'm horrified by this sort of cult of fake expertise that like the 18-year-olds have.
Yeah.
Let me tell you how to give your own freckles by poisoning yourself with this stupid ink you bought online. Like there's such bad advice on TikTok. If I were a parent, I think I would not allow my children to have access to TikTok because there's just so much terrible advice.
Do you use TikTok yourself or you just...
No one needs to see that. No.
So how do you feel like your job changed after the explosion of social media?
Oh, sure. It became much less relevant, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
I'm fortunate that I write for the Times when they want me to. And so I think the Times is one of the few institutions that has successfully navigated the current media era.
Mm-hmm.
They are making money. Most are not. I think the New Yorker, weirdly, is another success story. They massively increased the cost of their subscription because they moved the burden of paying for their publication from the advertisers, which went away mostly, to the subscribers. So those are two success stories. Most legacy publications are not thriving. Even like the giants of Condé Nast. I mean, that place is a ghost town now. You know, Vogue and GQ are not doing so well anymore. That's horrifying. So unfortunately, so to answer your question, there just aren't the legacy employers for dinosaur era folks like me that there used to be.
Yeah. And I feel like all of this, like publishing houses, like in the end, they are forced to cater to advertisers, like whether they want it or not.
Oh, they wish. Yeah. They barely have any advertisers anymore. I mean, one of the big criticisms of Chic Happens in like 1998 was we used to mock Vogue because they were so beholden to advertisers. They would never run a critical runway review of one of their advertisers because they relied on it so much. And we said that that was not good journalistic ethics and that they you know, basically you could buy your coverage in Vogue.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, a business model which was very successful for them for a long time but has gone away. I mean, Vogue is thin now.
Yeah. What would you say being just being cancelled mean today, like versus?
I do think that being cancelled is real. This is one of those endless online debates. Some people say, well, there's no such thing as being cancelled. There's only consequences for wrongdoing. Other people say, no, it's being real. And I think that in general, there's a lack of grace and there's a lack of any assumption of goodwill. So the problem with it, I think, is that everyone just assumes that everyone else has the worst possible intentions.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, there are some people who deserve to be cancelled. But in a lot of cases, honestly, just give the person a break. I mean, they may have misspoken, they may have, you know, said the wrong thing in the moment, but I think we need to learn to forgive each other. If the person is sorry for what they did, if not, then, you know, fuck them. But yeah, I think that we are too quick to execute the main character on social media.
So do you feel like, is anyone really, like, truly cancelled? Or
well, they tried to cancel you.
But from what?
Well, they stuffed you in a prison twice. I don't know. I think it's some people have the moxie to come back like you did. I mean, the trouble with the whole cancel debate is that it can push you into a really dark place because personally, you know, I'm a leftist. I'm not as far left as younger people, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm from the era of liberalism, which is dead now, which is fine. But the people who are really fighting the hardest against so-called cancellation are some pretty grim people. And they're not people I would personally want to associate with because they're some nasty folks. So although I do think cancellation is sometimes unfair, at the same time, I do not want to align myself with the people who are complaining about it the most because I don't agree with them.
Yeah. What's your take on Harry and Meghan and their relationship with attention?
Well, again, I'm very interested in their story because as a former gossip columnist, it was my job to pursue these people, not literally, not like a paparazzi on a scooter taking pictures, but you know, getting, you know, writing their secrets, it kind of was my job. So I did watch the documentary and I did read Harry's book, Spare.
Mm-hmm.
And I was intrigued to hear about what the experience was like for someone who was on the other side. And I would say it did positively affect my impression of the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when Harry spelled out how Meghan was persecuted by the press in England, who were much more vicious than the press in America has ever been, you know, it did make me sympathetic towards them.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think Meghan is perfect? Absolutely not. Do I think she's kind of calculated? Yeah, I do. But that's not a crime. I mean, and again, it's the old thing. Would a man be criticized for being calculated? Absolutely not. But she is.
Mm-hmm.
And what I thought was really interesting about it is the way they described that Meghan's job was to try to look good. Of course, she's Hollywood, so she can turn the wattage of celebrity on. But then she was criticized for that within the family because when she looked too good, she kicked the higher-ranking royals off the front page.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the cardinal sins from the family's point of view. So in that regard, I do think that she was in a no-win situation. Like, you've got to look good, but not too good. And, you know, the royal family is very strictly hierarchy, like regimented. There's no question where you are in the pecking order. Obviously, Camilla, as the queen, is the top dog.
Mm-hmm.
Her Majesty was alive at the time, of course, Queen Elizabeth. Camilla was sort of number two as the wife of the Prince of Wales. And then Kate Middleton as the queen in waiting. She's ahead of Meghan.
Yeah.
And Meghan outshined them all, really.
Yeah.
And she was punished for that. So I did have a lot of sympathy for them when I read that book. I also do take the point of people who say, well, look, you know, they're walking around with signs on their carrying signs saying, don't look at us. They are clearly making their money out of media here in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't have it both ways. All right, you know, your lordships, if you're going to sell yourselves as media properties, then scrutiny comes with that.
Yeah.
And I didn't entirely believe this story about the near catastrophic paparazzi chase in New York. So I don't buy everything they say, but I do have sympathy for the position that they found themselves in.
Yeah. Do you consume Australian media?
Not so much. Every now and then. There was a big fire in Sydney yesterday. I did see that.
I'm wondering, like, what's the difference between, like, the US media and the UK media and Australian media? Because I feel like all the English-speaking media, they kind of feed off each other, but they must be, like, catering to, like, the different sensibilities.
One of the reasons why I was attracted to come to New York City as a journalist is because this really is the world capital. You know, yeah. New York City is the capital of the world, and consequently, all the stories that I would be covering here as an entertainment reporter, a gossip reporter, you know, 80% of those are relevant in any country in the world because the United States exports celebrity. Yeah. Whereas if you're doing that kind of stuff in Australia, I mean, who cares? You're covering a rugby league star or a cricketer. It doesn't really travel. But, you know, my mother in Australia would be looking in her local paper at pictures of parties in New York, like the Met Gala or, you know, such and such a film premiere that I was at and I covered.
Yeah.
I think that... Certainly Australian media feeds off American media. Britain has more of a star ecosystem in place, so they have a lot of, like, local celebrities. I think that American culture, America exports culture. So for my job, it's interesting to be here.
Yeah. Do you think Trump is going to make a comeback?
Oh, I mean, I think he kind of never went away. I do think that's a big risk, yeah. And of course, they called DeSantis Trump incompetent, which is even more blood chilling. So, unfortunately, I think Trump has every possibility of coming back as president.
Well, were you following the Twitter spaces and Ron DeSantis announcing his campaign?
I did not try to tune in, which was just as well because I would not have been able to.
We tried. I was here with a friend and it just kept crashing nonstop. Right. It was interesting.
Well, what I find instructive about that is that DeSantis is clearly taking bad advice.
Yeah.
And for two reasons. One is just the instability of the platform, the basic, can you hear the guy speak? Well, no, you can't. So that's a problem. So just the functionality and the technical aspect. But also, I think it was a real strategic error because, you know, Elon Musk is going to steal the limelight. Why would he partner with another narcissist, you know, megalomaniac in what should have been his moment to shine? Mm-hmm. And I don't agree with DeSantis at all. In fact, I loathe his policies. I think that his anti-gay and anti-trans policies in Florida are basically a war crime. So I have no sympathy for him whatsoever. But as purely a strategic move, how stupid he was. Why would you share the spotlight with Elon Musk? Because he's going to take it from you. And he did, because the story became Elon.
I think because it's like he was thinking that Trump is not using Twitter and he could take over that platform. I think that was his main...
That's what Elon told him. Look, it has become a very right-wing place in the months since Elon has ordered. And all those idiot blue check marks are trying to sell their AI courses. Oh my God, they were NFT grifters and then they jumped on crypto and they were crypto grifters and now they're AI grifters. All those idiot men with their stupid threads and buy my course. Oh, such morons.
And I feel like he's done a big disservice with the blue check marks. With making it just available for everybody to buy. It was such a, it's really hard to navigate. It feels like now it's flipped. Yeah. Whoever does not have a blue check mark, the ones with the one you should stay away from.
Right, exactly. I think the blue check marks are, they're a badge of ideology.
Yeah.
And it's a particularly kind of anarcho-capitalist, libertarian, honestly selfish, horrible way of being, in my opinion, is a lot of people want to align themselves to that. So the blue check mark has become a badge of solidarity with your, you know, Elon Musk kind of like pirate capitalist.
Yeah. You really don't like Elon Musk, do you?
I don't. I think he's a horrible person. And I think that he's a good reason that the human race should not be on Mars, frankly, because if and Jeff Bezos is the same because they are, look, these are highly effective men and they are in some regards, you know, creating progress. Mm-hmm. It's good that we have electric cars. We're probably inevitably going to have space flight. These are two men who are pushing that, so that's good. But when I look at how utterly selfish and horrible they are, I'm like, we should not be exporting our species to other planets if this is how we behave. Huh. I'm becoming a supervillain as I get older. I'm like, yeah, basically just release the virus. The problem with the planet is basically people.
Do you think we are on the brink of class war?
Oh, I think we're always on the brink of class war. I think that unfortunately now we're on the brink of class war with weapons.
Yeah.
So I but it's just human nature to be envious and to care about other people's status. But social media certainly exacerbates the divisions between people. It always emphasizes the negative. I think social media is making the possibility of class war much more imminent and much riskier.
Yeah. Do you want to say something about your rules on journalistic integrity? And if you specifically follow any standards or how did you observe if your colleagues, any interesting stories about that? Because I feel like there's just so many situations where so many journalists end up in situations where it's gray area and it's
Hard to avoid. I think that's a good question. And it was something that I frequently had to defend myself on as a former gossip columnist because, fair enough, people think gossip columnists have no integrity.
Yeah.
And my response to that was always, well, you can do any job with or without integrity. You can be a cab driver or president of the United States with integrity or without it.
Yeah.
So I do think that it's something that you bring to the job and even as a gossip columnist. So you do need to privilege truth. You do need to not write mean things because of personal vendettas.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be trying to privilege yourself or your own little spats. You do need to apologize if you get something wrong and run a correction. But at the same time, not be paralyzed that you might get something wrong. As long as you don't have an agenda, as long as you assume good faith, if someone says you messed up, which, I did occasionally, then you run a correction and if appropriate, an apology. So I think it's there was a famous scandal in New York gossip press around 2006, where various reporters at Page Six, the preeminent New York City gossip column, were revealed to be taking cash and gifts in exchange for positive coverage. And the great irony is that's not actually illegal. It's illegal if you're an influencer to not tag your SponCon as ads, but it's not illegal for a journalist to take cash. There's this bizarre loophole in the law, which I've never understood. And indeed, some of the reporters who were found to be taking literal cash bribes, like bags of cash, kept their jobs. Others got fired. I would say just it's the same ethics you learn in grade school. Don't be corrupt. Don't take cash and do your best.
Yeah. Yeah, I know journalists or an insider, they are not allowed to accept any gifts over $100.
Right.
And I was like, it's wild because Anna Wintour gets sent gifts all the time that are much higher than this.
Right. Well, with the Times, they have a very strict policy, even for freelancers, which is tricky as journalism becomes harder to make a living from. Like at the Times, if you've ever accepted a press trip, for travel, that would disqualify you from writing for the Times, even if you're not writing about travel. It is trickier.
So nobody can pay for your way to go to an event.
Oh no, absolutely not. Yeah.
Does the Times cover it?
Yeah, I was the social columnist for a couple of years, so I would go to the Golden Globes and I would go to the Oscars.
Yeah.
And, of course, on a regular night in New York City, I'd be, bouncing around in cabs and on the subway. So they would cover the expenses, yes.
Yeah. Huh. So how does New York Times treat freelancers as opposed to their staff writers? That was always interesting to me.
That's a contentious question. They only this week's... The News Guild, which represents the Times employees, which the freelancers are not, only this week came to a contract conclusion with their long-running battle with management. And it does expose a bit of a rift because management would prefer to hire freelancers like me because we are cheap. And indeed, a detail that came out in the Times' own reporting was that the median salary of a New York Times reporter is $160,000, with benefits. And I can tell you that freelancing does not pay anything near like that. That.
Yeah.
And so management would prefer to rely on people like me because we don't get health insurance, We don't make anything like that kind of money. I think the staff report is kind of the US as a threat. So it can be a bit lonely as a freelancer. And there's kind of no one in your corner. There's no ombudsman. You're dealing with the staff editors who you rely on for your gigs, but you know they're not really on your side because you're taking work away from someone who's in house, and I understand that.
Would you rather be on staff somewhere or would you rather be a freelancer?
Well, that's a great question. If the New York Times offered me a job tomorrow, would I take it? I mean, probably not. I like my lifestyle. I mean, I'm Australian. My family's in Australia. Just last year, my mother passed, and that required me to be in Australia for 8 months as she got sick and then to handle her affairs after she died. So I need that flexibility. Mm-hmm. If I'd had a job at the Times, I would have had to quit to go and be with my mum. So, and in fact, I did quit a job. I was the editor-in-chief of Avenue Magazine, which was a job that I loved. Mm-hmm. But I had to quit in order to take care of my mother. So for me, the freelancer life has benefits.
Yeah. How do you choose which publications to write for?
Whoever will have me, Anna. I'm a freelancer. Look, I'm a jobbing journalist. We take jobs. It's like, you know, I think actors have the same, you know, attitude a lot of the times. You just need to keep working. Mm-hmm. Obviously I wouldn't... you know, one does have some standards. One has to keep the brand. I enjoy working for Tatler. I've written for Vanity Fair occasionally. You know, I write for the Times when they have me. So I do like to keep it on that level. But also I have specialities. I write about high society and I write about Hollywood. I wouldn't want to put that on deux mois, shall we say.
Yeah. So you must be like really like deep in the world. So I'm wondering how do you balance the social and professional relationships? Because I'm sure it kind of like... they mix.
Oh, to some extent. I am saved because I never want to be friends with any of the people I write about. And I don't understand. And I think people who do a bad job. And mm-hmm. certainly in the celebrity world, when I was hiring junior reporters, you would be flooded with people who were applying for a gossip column job because they want to meet their favorite celebrity and they have this fantasy that they're going to become friends. And you really have to weed those people out because they will be terrible at their job. The same way with covering the super rich. Like I cover the billionaire class. I don't want to be friends with these people. I want to cover them as my subject. I don't think that you can ethically do your job as a journalist if your real ambition is to insinuate yourself into the world of your subject.
Yeah. What would you say is the biggest difference between TMZ and New York Times?
The spelling. TMZ, I would have to say, had pretty high journalistic standards, different goals, shall we say. So it wasn't like TMZ was going through people's trash. Just to give you some context, TMZ has a terrible reputation, fair enough, because in its earliest days, they had very aggressive video paparazzi crews, and those were the days when it was still new to have video cameras mm-hmm. on the street. It was before cell phone video. So they were video paparazzi, and they did hire some freelance cowboys who would try to provoke the celebrities that they were tailing, because, of course, if the celebrity gets angry and retaliates, that's a much better segment, right? So there was a bit of that right at the beginning, and that gave them a terrible reputation, which they never outlived, long after they stopped doing that practice. So they did get a lot more respectful, but I think are forever tarnished by, you know, their tactics at the beginning. Look, my only complaint with TMZ is that it's trivial. I think gossip has to be interesting, and so much of on TMZ.com is just not interesting. It's like micro movements in a court case about someone you've kind of half cared about, and I don't know. I just think TMZ can be boring. The New York Times, in my opinion, is not boring.
What about your book? At what point did you decide now was the time to publish it?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I had just started doing my social column for the New York Times, and I had been out of gossip by that point for 10 years, so I felt that I had some perspective on it. And I think that there's a natural nostalgia delay, And people at about the 15-year mark become interested in things that they remember as an older person, and they're more willing to revisit and read about. And also with a bit of a distance, you can have some critical clarity mm-hmm. about what you were doing, which is not always clear at the time. So specifically, I really wanted to revisit how the gossip press, me included, treated young women like Britney Spears, like Lindsay Lohan, like Paris Hilton, and we were horrible to them. And again, there was a real public appetite for us to be horrible mm-hmm. to them. There was that horrible picture which we ran on the front page of the Daily News. It wasn't even in the gossip section because it was too important that Britney had shaved her head. And there was a picture the Daily News ran of her with a large golf umbrella smacking the SUV of a paparazzi photographer. And, you know, the media positioned that, we positioned that as, oh, look, she's crazy. And there was absolutely no sympathy for her whatsoever. There was no sense of this is a person who's having a mental health crisis.
Yeah.
And the way to treat that person is not put her on the front page and call her crazy.
Yeah.
So I think that I did want to interrogate those sins. And there are other things that I'm less ashamed of. Like I said, I always felt I did the job with integrity. But I think you have to own up to what you did wrong. And it felt like the right moment to talk about how we mistreated those women.
Yeah. So, like, you definitely have regrets about that era.
Yeah, sure.
Who were your favorites? And the least favorites?
Oh, well, Paris would always have a chat. I have a great deal of admiration for Paris Hilton mm-hmm. Because I would see she was a guest for hire. Mm-hmm. As she was getting more famous, her price tag went up, but you could pay her however many dollars and she'd come to your party.
Yeah.
And I saw her at so many awful parties and she always looked like she was having the best time of her life. And I just had a lot of respect for that, because she was hustling, she was making her coin, and she was giving the people who hired her good value. And certainly the techniques that she pioneered of self-promotion 10 years before the social media era are the same techniques that everyone's 14-year-old kid is using in their bedroom right now. So she was quite a visionary in terms of how to promote herself. I think she was the first influencer.
Yeah. Are you still friends with, were you ever friends with?
No, I was never friends with these people. That's my point. I never wanted to be friends with these people because I needed the freedom to criticize them when it was appropriate. For example, Paris Hilton could be terribly racist, and she would drop the N-word when there were no black people around, and there were recordings of that. And I covered that because it's reprehensible how she behaved.
Yeah.
So although I respect how she managed the fame part, do I think she's a good person? Not really. But professionally, you can't take it away from her that she invented modern celebrity. But, when she's dropping the N-bomb, you got to call her out on that.
Yeah. What do you think about my type of celebrity?
I think it's so interesting. And, you very kindly invited me to a party you had in this space. And I was really struck by all the young people who came here drawn by your flame. Mm-hmm. And you are an icon to a particular kind of Gen Z New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And I say New Yorker because I think that you exemplify a lot of why people come to New York. Mm-hmm. Are you a saint? Hell no. But, if you only want to meet saints, hang out in a church. I don't know. People come to New York to meet interesting people and you qualify. So I think that you are a very morally complex person. I think what makes you interesting is that people can have different opinions about what you did. Mm-hmm. I know you're appealing your case and you have been very upfront about the fact that you don't really think you did anything wrong.
Well, yeah, I went to trial. Like, I never took the plea, so...
Right. But look, people are talking about you over the kitchen tables, and some people are saying, that Anna Delvey is a terrible person. And other people saying, well, I don't know, she says she didn't do anything wrong, you look at it in a certain way. So what makes you interesting? You can talk about you. You can have different viewpoints. And the proof of the pudding is that people are drawn to you. Your party was mobbed. Young people are drawn mm-hmm. to you. So I think you are a complex person. I'm very honored to be your friend. I don't think everything you did was right, but again, I don't have to. I think you're an interesting case that's fascinating to discuss.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Have you ever been arrested yourself?
No, I haven't. Thank God. I'm too vanilla, Anna.
Would you ever be willing to get arrested for a story?
Oh, look, when I was in my 20s, I got my start in the what we called the gay media at the time. It's now the LGBTQ plus media, but it was in the 90s, we called it the gay media.
Yeah.
And I went to protests in London when I was in my early 20s. The big issue was, well, for one thing, it was AIDS. So there was always an AIDS rally going on. But the big political issue was age of consent because they had partially decriminalized male homosexuality in the UK, but they made the age of consent 21, whereas it was 16 for straight people. So that was that last thing that you had to like knock down. As your listeners may or may not be aware, being gay was straight out illegal in most of the Western world until like the 60s. Do you know something I learned the other day, which is horrifying, by the way?
What?
When the Allies liberated the Nazi concentration camps, they obviously liberated the Jewish people. They left the gays in there because the gays were sentenced, according to the Allies, under a legitimate penal code. They didn't let the gays out. I only just learned that. And so I bring that up. We've had anti-gay laws in the West for a long time. In the 90s, when I was young, I certainly laid down, stopped traffic in protest, and I never got arrested. Plenty did, but I, you know, the police would like drag you off by the scruff of the neck. So I've come close to it as an activist in my youth, but I was never actually arrested. Anna.
Yes.
Anna, I have some gossip for you.
Oh, no.
So we just took a momentary break, and during that break, there's a woman in the room who was a CNN reporter. Her name is Chloe. And she told me that she's married to Brian, who for years dated Tinsley Mortimer, who was one of the stars of Queenmaker, and Morgan Olivia Rose, who I mentioned, who was the former blogger who transitioned, loves to tell the story of the night that she stopped Brian from hitting me because, and I remember, Brian chased me around Tao, which was a nightclub of the moment one night. And Brian's like a big guy. He's like a personal trainer, like buff, or looks like a personal trainer, like lots of muscles. Very, you know, alpha male kind of vibe. And I did make some fun of Tinsley in print and maybe also Brian, you know, occasionally because I didn't treat them, again, to my point, I wasn't trying to be friends with these people. And Morgan loves to tell the story about the time she stopped Chloe's husband from beating my face in. So we've come full circle. And by the way, don't forget to watch CNN so you can see this podcast on television. So, Chloe, please give Brian my regards. Please thank him for not punching my face in. And I hope you guys are happy.
So it's been like one big family.
One big family. And, you know, there's a domestic violence hotline, I'm just saying. Should you ever need it, I'm not saying you do. But, you know, there's a number you can call should the need arise.
Would you like to explain to our listeners who, like, don't know what we're talking about a little bit more? And, like, maybe it's a good time to get into the show and just tell us more about it. How
about Queenmaker?
Yeah.
Sure. So it is based in part on a chapter from my book. And the first half of the documentary breaks down how if you were a young woman who arrived in the city around, you know, 2002-ish, mm-hmm. how you could become one of the socialites. And specifically, there was what we called the heiress trend. Because the Hilton sisters, Paris and Nikki, kicked off this fad for the young, very good-looking children of legitimate American aristocracy. The Hilton family obviously made their fortune from hotels in the 20th century, so they are American blue bloods. And then you have the Hearst cousins, a couple of sisters and one of their cousins, who made their fortune from the William Randolph Hearst publishing empire. And Casey Johnson, who was the daughter of the Johnson & Johnson, you know, pharmaceutical empire. Mm-hmm. Her dad, Woody, owns the New York Jets and became ambassador to the UK under Donald Trump. So, you know, really blue blood American families. And they became famous for that. I also think it had a lot to do with the Disney princess trend, which throughout the 90s, it was all about the Disney princesses. And suddenly you had these women who seemed to embody that for real. And of course, a part of it too was 9/11, because we were all so sad after that happened that there was a desperate need in the culture for something that was just light, frothy, fun, like innocent fun. All of those factors came together to produce the heiress trend. And women like Tinsley Mortimer came to New York. She's from Virginia, I think, originally. And they would employ a publicist like Corey Hay or Nora Lawler, who existed to shepherd these girls through society and make them famous. Tinsley, who's in the documentary, is a great example because she was very successful at it. She always dressed in pink. She was very photogenic. You know, she had the chihuahuas, as was required at the time. And she had a handbag line, also a necessary step. Dior named a shade of lip gloss after her Tinsley Pink, which was a huge coup for her. And then, but she wasn't able to maintain the status. Some of your listeners may be familiar with her from being on The Real Housewives for a bit. She dated Fanhul, which is a very wealthy sugar heir family who live in Florida.
I read her book. It was like Auto Fiction.
Yes.
I remember reading it. I was, I think, like in my teens.
Oh, is Chloe's husband in the book? What does she say?
I don't recall. It was a very long time ago. But yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah, it probably wasn't great listening. Yeah. Right, yeah. So the first half of the documentary is just how did those women do it? So I think people are going to be interested in that. There were two blogs that were quite prominent at the time. One was called Park Avenue Peerage. One was called Socialite Rank. They were both covering the socialite scene. The Park Avenue Peerage blog, turned out, was written by a young, at the time, male student living in the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, in a cornfield, and blogging about the socialite world in New York, just looking at the pictures, just reading the gossip columns, and doing it so persuasively that people thought, oh, this anonymous person must be an insider. It turned out to be a person then identifying as James, Kira's uncle, son of Indian immigrants. And he was 17 years old, came to town, and stayed for a bit. He got a job as an intern at New York Magazine, didn't really take to, I think, to the world, and then went back to Chicago. Fast forward 15 years, I contacted James, to say, hey, do you want to be in this film we're doing about that period? And the person who responded was Morgan Olivia Rose. It was a very glamorous, you know, woman living in Chicago. And she had transformed herself into a Tinsley-like person. And we do reunite Morgan and Tinsley in the film. So the first half is based on my book, but I didn't know that Morgan had transitioned. So the second half, honestly, is kind of much more interesting. And it's about this person's story of transition and what she thinks of the socialite world 15 years later, and I don't want to spoil it, but she has a very different view of whether that world is attractive and the misogyny of that world now than she did then.
Yeah. And what was your role? You were...
I was a producer.
Yeah.
And I'm also one of the narrators in the film.
All right. And how long did it, like, how was the whole process? What was it like?
Oh, long. It was long, as long as doing another book. It took about 2 years.
Yeah.
I think we did interviews in the summer of 21, maybe. And it just came out in May 23 on Hulu. But it was interesting. It was a very different experience. And of course, I didn't have any creative control. I was just, my role really was to introduce the filmmakers to the people who were present at the time. Kelly Catrone, who is a publicist who gives great quotes. She had her own Bravo series back in the day.
Oh my gosh, I know her. Yes. I shout her out. Yeah.
She's great.
She like sent me a message wanting to come to my party. It's actually really funny. Let me see. I know she played for you. I love her. It's so,
she's great.
Yeah. I used to watch her show, The Republic PR, The Revolution. What was the
People's
name?
Revolution.
People's Revolution. Yeah. I used to watch the show when I was little.
Hell on Earth.
Yeah. And I was like, she's so cool.
Her famous catchphrase was, if you have to cry, go outside.
So, just giving some context for, the listeners, a friend of mine sent me this clip from Leah McSweeney's podcast.
Let's also not forget that the reason you are, the reason that Anna Delvey decided to come to New York and scam a bunch of people.
So this is a conversation between Leah and Kelly.
I didn't get invited. Did you? No.
We did not get invited.
Pat Marnell went. We want an invitation.
I know.
This is a call.
Anna, let us know. We want an invite. Kelly really deserves the invite.
You have a ankle bracelet on. You spray painted gold and invite us to your house because you're going to be the repeat. You're the next repeat guest. I've already come here twice. There's only been three guests, okay? I challenge you. You f***ing do it, bitch.
So how do you see, like, Kelly in comparison, like, to somebody to, like, R. Kui Hay?
Oh, well, they sort of have different niches. Corey Haim has a very interesting life story. He was involved with the Warhol crowd early on, as actually Kelly was too. She married a guy called Catrone, who was one of the artists in that circle. And Corey now does... Ronnie Catrone was his name, I think. Corey does socialite wannabes as well as, you know, other products and very successfully can show you how to navigate that world. Kelly is very deeply involved in the fashion world and she will produce a fashion show and she will make sure that, she, you know, you don't have gate crashes in your front row if you want to show in New York Fashion Week. Which is a very hardcore business and she does it very well. So Kelly is event production, hardcore Fashion Week girl. Corey handles the sort of nuances of high society.
Yeah. So what's like your relationship like with PR people as a reporter?
Oh, I think we're codependent, you know. Mm-hmm. We need each other. Something that a PR professional said to me when I was a young reporter in town was that they always prioritize their relationship with the press over the clients because clients come and go, but press will always be there. So it is true that sometimes we get into fights, especially with the personal PRs in Hollywood, because they are ruthless and they tend to dislike the press greatly. Also, I think it's kind of an LA mindset. It's a much more adversarial relationship between the press and the PR industry in Los Angeles because LA is a one industry town.
Yeah.
And therefore the PRs have much more power. In New York, the PRs have less power because there's much more going on here. So, for example, writing a gossip column in New York, you have the fashion industry, you have the art world, you have Wall Street and business to write about, you have book publishing, you have media, you have 1,000 things to write about, and the celebrity PRs have much less leverage.
Yeah.
So you can, because you can really afford to piss them off and there's always something else to write about. I think in New York, the PRs are more willing to deal.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. I feel like the role also shifted for PR people with the rise of the social media. Because now a person, like, they don't necessarily need a PR, PR person to, like, get something out, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they do and they don't. Some people do it really badly. So I think it's if you have the talent to do it yourself, then you don't need a PR person, and many people do. But you know what? Some people don't. So I think there will always be a market for a qualified, competent public relations expert.
Yeah. So it's like right now I'm still on house arrest and I'm prohibited from accessing any social media by the judge order. And this is kind of the main thing that I miss about not having a platform, just kind of assuming the control of the narrative. And I can't really like post something and announce something I'm working on or my project. I'm like relying on mainstream media to hopefully communicate the message the way I like them to.
So that's interesting. Where do they draw the line between your access to media? Because you're doing a podcast. So that is something that is permitted under your circumstances?
Well, it's not social media.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. It's just...
Did you ask them?
Yeah, that doesn't fall under the definition of social media.
Okay, all right, so they've given you a definition of social media.
They actually do not give me a definition of social media. They, you would have to defer to your supervisor, I think. But
did you ask your supervisor
if I'm allowed to go on a podcast?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been doing it for a while.
Okay,
all yeah,
because you do have a history of pissing off your supervisors and and the authorities.
I actually never violated like my criminal parole or ICE. So like I'm on like day to day personal level, like I've never really had any issues with like people I have to deal with, yeah, on a daily basis. It's like always kind of like the higher up person, who is upset. I never had like nobody really gives me a hard time. So well,
you've told me that they do follow your media, and that an issue they had earlier was that you didn't seem very contrite, and that kind of tweaked their nose a little bit.
That was during my bond hearings, immigration bond hearings. The government used it against me, and it's really easy kind of like to twist anything.
Sure.
They use, for example, like headlines that were created by the editor, like, sorry, not sorry. They ascribed it as a quote of mine. And it's like sad for me to like sit in that courtroom saying, no, I didn't say that. And it's like, well, but weren't you convicted of like lying and fraud? So you have no credibility. So it's like, it's a weird setup.
Yeah.
You don't really get like to argue back and forth.
Right.
Yeah.
It seems like you have to show a lot of obeisance. That's what they want. Like you have to like get down on your hands and knees and, you know, make them feel like they're the top dog is a real part of the performance of the legal system.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like just immigration and criminal, like also my experience was like very different because criminal justice system is just, it's like public. You can access anybody's records. Like you can go to people's court dates. Like there are less secrets while immigration is civil. So you can't really access anybody's immigration records unless like they give it to you. So I think it like works both ways. Obviously you have more privacy, but it's also less transparency from like both sides. It's just, yeah, like they can get away with much more.
And you don't really have any updates, right, about how it's going. Like it's a bit of a black box for you as someone who's going through the process of your appeal and the implication it has for your possible deportation.
For now, yeah. Well, we appealed everything. We just did not hear back. We did not get the ruling, but it just takes a while. And yeah, that's another thing. There's only one Board of Immigration Appeals in the country.
Okay. Oh, wow, really?
It's in Virginia, yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and they don't have a deadline by which they have to respond, so they can take like a week or a year.
Right.
Yeah, and like they also separate detained and non-detained cases, so usually they take longer for non-detained ones, which is like okay for my main case, but for my bond appeal, for example, like I'd love to get a decision as sooner or later, but it is what it is.
So how is your mental health holding up being under house arrest in not a very large space?
I mean, it's just like it's different every day. Like I'm trying to keep busy and not like just think about how unfair life is.
Right.
Like on the other hand, I could have just like left to Europe. I guess it's kind of upsetting that people don't really like give me credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
Like I could have left in 2021. But I choose like to stay and fight it. And like I spend so much time and money just like, going through the system.
I mean, I think you're a New York character and I think you make a lot of sense in New York.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you did go to Europe, I wonder whether the culture of Europe would be as receptive as the culture of New York is.
I'd be out of context anywhere else.
Yeah,
so.
Do you think so?
Like I'm not really doing it for like fame purposes or anything like that. I just feel like, most of my adult life, like I associate with like being in New York.
Yes.
And
yes.
Just most of my friends I've made, I hear, just New York just feels home. Even though I did not spend that much time in here, it's just like literally the only city where if I'm in New York, I don't have like fear of missing out being anywhere else.
Sure. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So, you know, even like when you're in Paris or remember being in Berlin, I always check. It's like, oh, what's going on in New York? Like, what are people doing there? I don't have that feeling when I'm in here.
Right.
Like everything else feels secondary in a way.
Right. Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions for my next dinner party?
Oh, in terms of the menu or the guests?
Just any ideas. Yeah, so this is kind of one of the few things that I'm able to do while being on house arrest. And I know you've been to my birthday party in January.
You should definitely invite Kelly Catrone. That woman is a quote machine, and I think she will fit in very well. I don't know. Why don't you invite your parole officer?
Parole officer, yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Do you think they'd come?
I don't think they're allowed to like accept invitations.
Right, no fraternizing. So, and you are allowed to get on the subway to go and meet your parole officer, right?
I'm allowed to use any mode of transportation to.
Now, you did that great, was it a shoot for New York Magazine?
That's right, yeah.
Do you still dress up to get on the subway like that?
No, not really, not anymore, no. I try to walk, so I'll go to like two different places once a month to Brooklyn. They still did not transfer me.
Okay.
I live in Manhattan, but my first address I gave them was in Brooklyn back in 2021.
Oh, right. Okay.
And for whatever reason, 8 months later, I'm still in Brooklyn. Even though I'm supposed to be like with a Manhattan parole office. Right. But when the weather is nice, I usually like walk with a friend.
Okay, nice.
It's a nice walk. It's it's a long walk. It's like an hour and a half, hour 40 minutes usually.
But if you don't get a chance to get out, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, or at least like partial. Like I walk part of the way, you would take the car.
Right.
The rest. So, and I go to ICE once a week, which is downtown, 26 Federal Plaza to report. Yeah.
No. So, I mean, I have to say the food at your birthday dinner was phenomenal. Like you had a really great chef and the wine was first rate. So, for your listeners, if you ever get invited to Anna's for dinner, you should come because the food's great.
Oh, thanks. That was, I guess, not. I don't cook, so.
No, right. And Kat Rinell was here, as you just said. I see her book on your book pile there in the corner, next to a very large stack of Wall Street Journals. By the way, listeners. So if you've never been to Anna's house, it's small. It's in East Village apartment. There's a big stack of Wall Street Journals. There's Bret Easton Ellis. There's Kat Rinell. There's an Elon Musk book there, and there are also pizza boxes in the corridor. So that is.
I was recording podcast last night, and it's really hard to keep the place. I guess this is like my biggest struggle, having to host all the time.
Right.
Just like keeping the place tidy because I don't really have much storage room.
But you have chairs now. You never used to have chairs.
I know. That's a major life upgrade. Yeah.
So before, when you came to visit Anna, like I think there was two chairs and Anna would sit on the floor if she had two guests.
Yeah. Now I have like this cute vintage folding chairs because I just could not find chairs that would look good, folding chairs.
Yep.
It has like this high school feel and I didn't want that. I'd rather sit on a floor than having ugly chairs. But
again, for those not here, Anna's folding chairs are gold and they have this kind of aquamarine/emerald velvet upholstery. They're very chic.
A friend of mine brought them over for a dinner party, and I guess they just left them here. So it was like an accidental find.
Hey, how's your art world? How's your artwork selling?
It's doing great. I don't have anything here because everything is like with a gallery and like loaning pieces for events and stuff. And the piece you see here is by Kenny Schachter.
Oh, yeah. And the piece is a cardboard cutout, not quite life-size, but, you know, large-ish of Anna with a...
It's wooden canvas.
It's wooden canvas, and it has an actual ankle bracelet, or like a real plastic and with the straps ankle bracelet on the ankle.
I interviewed Kenny for the podcast, too, and he's made this for me. We exchanged artworks. He, like, took a portrait of him. Made by me, and he gave me this.
I think it's wonderful. Although your personal styling is better now. You're in your courtroom mode.
Yeah, I don't always keep it out because I'm just here all the time. I don't want to stare at myself. It's usually in my bedroom.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah. But look, getting a Kenny Schachter original artwork, that's a score. Good for him. Good for you.
So let us know, where can we follow you and where can we watch your latest show?
Queen Maker premiered on Hulu in May. It's going to be there for the foreseeable future. My Twitter is at Ben Widdicombe, but I don't tweet. So I don't know. Check me out anyway.
Oh, thank you so much for coming. It was a pleasure having you. And I'm just looking forward to what's next.
Anna, your apartment is the hottest invitation in downtown New York. And I'm so grateful for coming and having you inviting me. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. From TMZ to the New York Times. What a true rags to riches story. Now I just have to think about what I could possibly do next to become interesting enough for Ben to write about me again. The Anna Delvey Show is a Reunion Audio and Audio App production. The show is produced by Sean Glass, sound supervised and co-produced by John Eckhouse. Say, hey, oh, hey, oh. What the hell? Hey, when it rains.
Audio up. Reunion Audio?